You're listening to Just Women on Brooklyn's Radio. You can join in by emailing any comments or questions you may have to justwomen@brooklynsradio.co.uk or check us out on Facebook. Search for Just Women at Brooklyn's Radio. Just Women is just what you need.
Welcome to a special edition of Just Women, the weekly talk show on Brooklyn's Radio with me, Jackie Mitchell. In this special programme, we pay tribute to Alison Florence, a former presenter of the programme, who sadly passed away. I worked with Alison on the programme for several years, and we also sang together at Elmbridge Ladies' Choir. With her background in local BBC radio, Alison was very professional and calm. She was expert at juggling, interviewing guests at the same time as running the desk. Alison always put nervous guests at ease with her friendly presenting style, making it into an interesting discussion. As her co-presenter, we interviewed guests together, and we quickly devised a system. I would look at her and raise my eyebrows when it was her turn to ask a question, and vice versa. It worked very well. In our first segment, Alison interviews actor Neris Hughes, who is probably best known for starring in TV comedy The Liverbirds in the 1970s, which ran for 10 years, and also The District Nurse in the 1980s. It's fascinating how Neris met her husband Patrick, as Alison found out.
I'm here today with Weybridge resident who has a very long and varied career in the acting profession, working in comedy, drama, Shakespeare and science fiction. And some of the programmes that she has been in are The Likely Lads, Dixon of Dot Green, Z Cars, The District Nurse and Doctor Who, to name but a few. But the one that I best remember and ran for 10 years was very much part of my television viewing in the 70s, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners feel the same, The Liverbirds. And I'm sure nearly all of you now will know that I am talking here to the actress Neris Hughes. So really nice to be here with you today, Neris.
Hello, Alison.
Now, going back to your early days, how did you first get the confidence to become an actress?
Well, I went to a college that was a dual course. It was for teaching and acting, which was a jolly good idea. It was my father's idea, just in case I didn't make it as an actress. And at the end of it, at the end of the three-year course, there was a competition, and it's across all the drama schools, and it was for a six-month contract with the BBC Radio. And I was going to be a teacher, but I thought, well, I'll just do this prize of six-month contract, and then I'll go back to teaching. And I loved it. I loved being in the drama rep on the radio. And I've ever since loved doing radio and audiobooks. And at the end of it, a boyfriend of mine was doing an audition for Stratford, the Royal Shakespeare Company. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just do that and see how I get on. And I got into Stratford, not playing leading parts, but had a wonderful time. I thought, well, I'll do that and then I'll go back to teaching. And then I had the enormous luck of joining the English Stage Company at the Royal Court. And really, it was beginning to wear a bit thin that I was going to be a teacher, because by now I was really an actress. And I loved acting. And to tell you the truth, I did enjoy my teaching course too. But I've been so lucky, Alison. I've jumped and leapt from stepping stone to stepping stone through my career. And I was never really out of work for about 40 years, to tell you the truth. And I'm very, very old now. And
No, you're not, Neris. Not at all.
Yes,
you haven't changed a bit.
Very, very old. And so looking back on it, I think, what a lucky career. Because, like you said, I did drama and comedy, and I did theatre and television and film, and I never got bored, and had two wonderful children and a fabulous husband along the way. Well, the husband came first, of course.
Now, here you had a really interesting way of getting together with your husband. Not like a dating agency or anything like that. What happened?
It was quite exciting how we met, because I was doing an episode of The Expert, and I was murdered, and I was lying in a ditch, and the episode went back over how I got killed. And Patrick was the film cameraman, and I was lying in this ditch, and a car was meant to come screeching to a halt by my body. And Patrick was filming me and saw that the driver, was going to go straight into me. He couldn't stop in time, and he rolled me and his camera into the ditch and saved my life. Well, I had to marry him then, didn't I?
Well, I suppose you do. So I wouldn't be talking to you now, Neris, if Patrick hadn't been around, would I?
Well, I'd have been severely injured, if not, you know, killed. And it was kind of instant, really. We were both enjoying our careers and not looking for marriage or settling down, and it we just clicked, and that was it.
So that sort of career where you're doing acting things, it's not the sort of career that tends to fit in with a family, is it? Because you're working long hours, different hours, weekends, and you've got two children. So how did that work for you?
Very difficult, Alison. I don't think there's an answer to this. And tell you the truth, I still feel guilty when I look back. But Patrick always says, don't be so silly. They had a lovely life. I had it written into my contract when I was doing District Nurse, which was filming in Wales, and Live of Birds, and we filmed in Liverpool. And so whenever possible, they came with me to filming, like with District Nurse. Even though I was rehearsing in London, I was actually filming in Wales, and so Patrick would bring them down, especially during the holidays, and they'd take part in it. They'd have little parts in it. And I was so thrilled to have children, and so was Patrick. We're very family. They came first, but it was difficult. I think every mother that's listening to this would sympathise, because whatever your profession, I think it's one of the most difficult parts of it, that you want to be there for your children, but you also want to, number one, pay the mortgage, and number two, you want to actually broaden your career, and they can be part of it. And they were. I mean, when Ben was about two, he used to come with me, and I was in an Ibsen play, The Wild Duck, and he was sitting through it, good as gold, sitting in the audience listening. He was wise beyond his years, really. He was a very interested, intelligent child. So was Marie Claire. But Ben had this kind of focus and concentration, and he still kept it, even though he's a film cameraman like his dad now. He used to just come and watch me.
So where did you get your confidence from to do all this sort of thing? Because you need to be really confident to be in front of audiences. Were you sort of encouraged as a child to be like that?
Well, in Wales, we have this thing called Eisteddfods, which are like festivals of the arts, like poetry and music and singing. And you either have them locally in your local town, or you have them nationally, like the National Eisteddfod, International Eisteddfod. And I used to go in for those, and I was always quite confident, reciting and things. And they were all in Welsh, of course, but I did enjoy that. And I used to do plays at school, and there was an influential teacher there. And then I don't know, I have always been very confident in my career. I'm not always confident in everything, not by any chalk, but I am confident in my career. The only thing that ever would terrify me is forgetting my lines, and that's a very real fear.
Because I tend to get the feeling, if you're confident in talking with people, that you're confident with everything. So you said, what sort of things wouldn't you be confident in now?
I suppose the things I'm not so confident about, if I now was doing a stage play, I'm not so kind of lively as I was. I've always had huge energy all my life, because having two children and a career and everything, really my days used to start at 5 and end at midnight or something quite often. And even though I'm still pretty energetic, I haven't got that steam engine type thing you need for the theatre. I would be quite nervous of doing theatre now. I haven't done theatre for a bit. And television, I always feel a bit self-conscious, because I've sunbathed all my life, and Patrick's always said, now stop it, you're ruining your skin. And, you know, I'm very aware that close-ups and things like that. You know that joke that film stars always say, how much do I have to pay you for my close-up? I'm the opposite. How much do I have to pay you not to do me in close-up? And I suppose, in general, it's not a confidence thing. It's a more of, I can't actually do what I used to do quite to the extent. I've still got a lot of energy, and I've got enthusiasm, but I've got to know my limitations now.
When was the last time you actually did something in front of cameras or on a stage?
Oh, last week. I did an interview and the week before I did too. And I did a pilot for a comedy series about a month ago. I do the odd thing, but it's very much an odd thing. I'm doing an audio book of Torchwood. It's a drama. And I'm quite looking forward to that because I did do a Torchwood and it was great fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in Doctor Who about 40 years ago and I was in Torchwood about 5 years ago. I quite like the fact that even though I'm not doing so much, I like keeping in touch with young people, and it sort of gives me a little bit of a frisson. I enjoy it.
I was going to ask you, going back to when you were in the acting profession in your heyday, there was none of this people photographing you all the time, taking selfies and things like that. Whereas now, you feel really sorry for people because they don't have the privacy that you used to have, do they? How do you feel about the difference in the way things are?
You're right in that I was never harassed. Yes, I was photographed a lot. Mm. I used to go out shopping and it was almost continual somebody be photo or asking for an autograph, but I didn't mind because after all, when Liberbos was on, for instance, it was the 70s and there were only about three channels on the television. So we'd have 17 million people watching. Also, what you've got to remember, it was a very joyous series and so everybody loved it and people were just wanting to say hello, and I didn't mind at all. Mostly it was just people enjoying the fact that they loved the programme. They actually felt they were part of our lives, family that people identified with. In fact, most people say to me, I always wanted to share a flat when I saw Live Births. And that's the reaction. So I didn't mind a bit. And even now, because it's always on some television, Gold or Dave or something like that, there's always something on. And all over the world, I still get masses of mail.
I hear you were also on This Is Your Life once. How did you feel about that? Was that a shock?
Yes. I mean, to tell you the honest truth, I said to Patrick, if they ever put me, don't you dare let them.
So Patrick knew, did he?
Well, he had to. They tell the family, you see, and they get all your family up from Wales. And I'd said, I haven't done enough because I was still very young when they did it. But I loved it. And it was Eamon Andrews. And I thought I was going to go and do an interview. And actually, it was in the Hilton Hotel. And I'd had a very bad night with the kids. They'd got colds or something. And I went up to the reception and there was Molly Sugden and Liz Estenson and Polly James on reception. And I said, what are you doing here? And I'd had a very bad night. So I thought that I was hallucinating. I said, and they said, would you like to book a room? And then I looked at the doorman standing next to me and his moustache was peeling off. And I realised it was Eamon Andrews. And he said, Nara Shoes, this is your life.
Did you feel like running away?
Well, no. It was such fun. I was so wrong. Patrick helicoptered. He's a film cameraman. And he helicoptered from Scotland where he was working. And the kids had been filmed at home earlier. And everybody of my family seemed to be there. It was such fun. Yes.
And talking about fun, do you still have fun now and do things you enjoy?
I'm very lucky in that Patrick and I are very much wanting to laugh a lot. Pretty big priority that we laugh and, you know, either read each other something out of the papers or find the funny side of things. I reckon that's fairly high on the agenda for us too. We've got a boat in France. We took it over through the canals and rivers. And I've got my funny little boat called Blodwen on the river down there because we live right on the river, as you can see. So you can't live on the river and not have a boat. But we don't do as much as we used to, but Patrick is passionate about his boat. And it's in France. And when we were taking it through the rivers and canals, it was quite funny because our first grandchild was born. And so we had a big hiatus and we went to a place called Briar and left it there for about 18 months because we wanted to enjoy our grandchild. And I did a bit of work as well. So we used to go and visit the boat. And then we took it up again and took it to where we live in the south of France.
So any plans to do any more acting where we can see you on the television or on the stage?
Well, to tell you the honest truth, I've done a couple of pilots, but I can't seem to settle. I can't seem to find something that I really like. I don't think I'll do any more stage, but I still do quite a lot of audiobooks and things like that. And if a television came up that I really like the script of, I've got one being sent to me now, actually. But yes, if something turned up, of course I'd do it. I'm an actress deep down inside, but I do like my life here. But Patrick and I are like a couple of swans. We go up and down the river and kind of, you know, mated for life.
It's always nice when you've got interests in common and things, isn't it?
Well, I don't know about interests in common, because he's very technical and I'm so untechnical. I am absolutely useless. I can't even sew. I'm not good at all, anything like that. And so in some ways, and he loves old cars and boats, so in some ways it's a mixture of our differences and our togetherness. It's quite a nice cross-section of the two.
Well, it's been very interesting hearing about your life, and I'm sure so many of our listeners today will be really impressed to know all the different things you've done and look forward to seeing you on the television or maybe on some television adverts, Neris, you never know.
Ooh.
Skin cream or something.
I wouldn't be a very good after one, would I? I could do the before.
Thank you very much for talking to us today. It's
pleasure,
been fascinating.
Alison.
Alison conducted many outside broadcasts on behalf of Brooklands Radio over the years. We're going to share with you her broadcast on site at Brooklands Museum in Weybridge, which in 1907 was the first purpose-built racing car circuit in the world. Here she interviews David Nadell, Development Director, about the museum's £7 million aircraft factory and racetrack project.
Now, today I'm here in Weybridge, in what must be one of the most fascinating historical places in the area. It was the first purpose-built racing car circuit in the world, which was built in 1907, one of the first aerodromes in the UK, and between 1908 and 1987 produced over 18,000 aircraft of over 200 types. It also influenced a film that I'm sure most people must have seen, Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines, and it had the test flight of the VC-10 prototype in 1962. Well, I'm sure a lot of you have guessed where it is, but for those who haven't, I'm here in Brooklands Museum. The Heritage Lottery Fund helped fund a £7 million aircraft factory and racetrack project. And with me to talk about this and tell us more today is David Nagel, who's the Development Director. What is this project all about?
This project really has two aspects to it. The first, and the way the project started, was to understand how we can better protect some of the working aircraft that we have in our collection. The second aspect of the project was reclaiming some of the elements of the historic racetrack which are still within the museum's grounds. The project achieves both of those aims by taking the Wellington aircraft hangar that currently sits on top of the original finishing straight of the racetrack, dismantling that and rebuilding it in a different part of our site. So the Wellington aircraft hangar, which was erected in 1940 at the start of the Second World War to help increase aircraft production on the site, will be dismantled, moved about 100 yards to the left, and reassembled and reinvented as the Brooklands Aircraft Factory, displaying some of the sections of aircraft that we have in our collection. Behind the Brooklands Aircraft Factory, we'll build a new flight shed which will display our working aircraft, as well as having purpose-built archives and storage for our collection. Because the aircraft hangar moves off the finishing straight, we'll then restore that finishing straight, and visitors will be able to get a sense of what it was like to race on the Brooklands racetrack pre-World War II.
So is this all about cars rather than aircraft?
It started off really as an aircraft project. It started off as a project to help us tell the story of aircraft production at the Brooklyn site. Because when we were looking at how we restore the aircraft hangar, we realised that we would have to take it apart to do that restoration. It then made sense that when we put it back together, we took it off the finishing straight. So really, one of the best things about this project from our point of view is that it helps us tell the story of aviation at Brooklands, but also gets back this key aspect of the original racetrack, which was, of course, as you said in your introduction, was the world's first motor racing circuit.
So have you had to have volunteers to help you, or will you have volunteers to help do this project, or is it all going to be professional builders?
Well, no, I mean, volunteers already play a really important role at Brooklands, and they will continue to play that role in this project. I mean, the construction and the revival of the racetrack will obviously be undertaken by a team of professionals, but we have volunteers who are working, who are helping us with some of the restoration of the individual objects that we have that will go into the racetrack. And obviously, a lot of the volunteers, when we reopen the site and we have this new facility of the aircraft factory and the flight shed, will be dependent on volunteers, as we are now, to help our visitors really understand what went on at Brooklands and understand the objects that we have in our collection.
So do the volunteers that you have already have the knowledge, or do you sort of have like training sessions for volunteers to teach them what they need to know?
It's a bit of a mixture, really. We have a number of our volunteers used to work at Brooklands when it was the British Aerospace site. So a lot of them have first-hand knowledge of the Brooklands site. A lot of them will be vintage or classic car enthusiasts, so they'll understand, they'll have the passion for motor racing that really helps them convey what went on at Brooklands. But we also have people who just want to come along and volunteer, and we have training sessions for those to help them really understand the objects that we have in our collection, both aviation and motor racing, and help them explain those to our visitors.
So, moving away from this project, some people who've never actually heard of Brooklands Museum, can you just list a few of the things that are actually on view here?
We've got a number of vintage and classic cars from that pre-World War II period, when motor racing really had its heyday at Brooklands. The jewel in our crown, I suppose, is the 4-litre Napier Railton, which set a number of world land speed and world endurance records. That's on display at Brooklands. We have the Wellington bomber that was built at Brooklands and which ditched in Loch Ness towards the end of the war. That was salvaged from the bottom of Loch Ness in the mid-80s, and that was brought to Brooklands, and that takes pride of place currently in our Wellington hangar and will take pride of place in the new aircraft factory. We've got a complete Concorde, which people can come and visit. We have a 4D theatre where people can experience what it was like to race round the Brooklands motor racing circuit in that Napier Railton. And we have a number of complete aircraft from the post-World War II Vickers aircraft factory. We have a replica Sopwith Camel. We have a replica Vickers Vimy, which was the first aircraft to cross the Atlantic. 4 years ago, the London Bus Museum moved to Brooklands, and it's a separate museum, but it's on our site, and it's once you pay to get into Brooklands, then entry into the bus museum is free.
Well, there's loads of things going on here, and so thanks very much indeed, David, for telling us about it today.
Thank you.
In the last segment, Alison's feet were firmly on the ground, but not in this next interview. Always game for anything, Alison was a passenger in an exhilarating ride in a vintage car, a 1930s Aston Martin International, up the Test Hill Circuit at Brooklands Museum. Let's hear how she got on.
Now, I'm here with Diana in one of the very old cars. How old is this car, Diana?
This car it's a replica of a 1930s Aston Martin International, but it's actually based on a 1968 MGB, so the engine and the body is made to look like a 1930s Aston Martin, so it's very much in the Brooklands style. And being an MGB underneath, it's quite robust as well for going on the banking and up the Test Hill. So
now that's where we're going. We're on a car ride up the Test Hill circuit here. So I'll tell you what it's like as we start off. We're just getting into gear now.
First of all, we're going up the famous Test Hill, which is 1 in 8 to 1 in 4. So very steep for the really old cars. And some of them struggle, but hopefully we should be all right in this car, which is not quite so old.
The first thing I've noticed here is they don't have seat belts in these cars. So they weren't so safety conscious in those days, were they?
No, they didn't have safety belts and all those health and safety rules that we have now.
Now we're just waiting for the flag to go up to tell us that we're clear to go up this very steep bank. And how different is it to driving a normal modern car?
It's no power steering, so it's heavier going around corners. But apart from that, it's quite easy. You just learn, you get used to it quite quickly. It's a great little car, especially when the sun's shining and we're out in the open, and it's good fun.
What sort of speed does it get up to?
Not very fast, actually. It feels faster because there's no roof, and obviously you're also on a bit of an angle at the banking because they raced on the original racetrack at a sort of 30-degree angle. As it feels faster, it's probably only about 30, 35 miles per hour, actually.
It feels like about 70.
Oh, it feels like at least 70, yes, yeah. The banking, in theory, you need to go above 30 because it's a slope and could slip down, so that's the theories.
I've noticed even now, just with the engine running before we start, it's quite noisy, isn't it? It's not the sort of car that you could actually have a conversation in easily.
No, and it's a very typical MGB sound, actually. Obviously, with no roof, you hear it more as well. So, a bit noisier and more adds the atmosphere.
Well, I think we're just about to be off now, and the flag is waving.
Three,
two, one, go! Now, we feel here as though we're going about 70 miles an hour, but looking at the speedometer, we're only going about 30. So you're certainly right on that one, Diana.
Quite strict speed limits as well, but yes, that felt much faster. I think you'll agree.
Definitely.
Going up that steep hill. And now we're just coming around what we call a return road through the woods. And then we will emerge at the bottom of the original racetrack, the banking, where they raced at well over 100 miles an hour around the top.
When you say they raced 100 miles an hour, presumably the surface of it was a lot smoother than it is now.
It was uneven. It was uneven then, but it's certainly more uneven now. So it's a bit of a rough old ride on the surface. And, of course, that also means constant maintenance on the cars. So if you're ready, we'll...
I'm ready.
...pop along the banking. This gives you a flavour of the angle.
Now, I feel here as I'm almost tipping out of the car here, so I'm having to hang on to the handle. If I hadn't been holding on then, I think I would have tipped out.
Well, fortunately, we don't have doors in this car, so that's quite handy as well.
That would have been rather a sad end to a very lovely trip if I'd fallen out.
It would. It would have been very more than disappointing. So as we come round here, we've got the Wellington hangar on the left, and over there, Concorde on the right. There's a Wellington bomber in the Wellington hangar, brought out of Loch Ness after it ditched on a training fight. Back to the clubhouse. So did you enjoy that?
That was wonderful, Diana. Thank you very much. And to actually hear how it feels and all the bits of information has been another bonus.
So we're doing the car ride half terms on holiday. We're doing another couple of days as well as today. So luckily the weather's good, and we've got queues of people waiting now.
And do you do them at weekends normally?
No, we do weekdays only, but we do also do weddings and corporate events. So and the whole car ride's effort is all to raise funds for Brooklands Museum.
Well, very worthwhile one. Thanks very much indeed for the trip.
That's a pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, that sounded lots of fun. In the next part of the programme, we found out more about Alison herself, as Mandy Dineley, Just Women presenter, interviews her about what it's like to be a wedding registrar. This was just one of Alison's activities she became involved in after retirement. Let's hear about her experiences.
We have our very own Alison, who's going to be telling us all about what it's like to be a wedding registrar. So, hello, Alison.
Hello.
Now, we're going to be talking to each other.
Yes, that's nice, isn't it? I'm sure we'll find plenty to talk about, won't we?
We will. And I know you're multi-talented, but how did you come about being a wedding registrar?
Well, the really strange thing was that I must have seen an advert asking for people to become what they call sessional registrars, which is just doing weddings, so I don't do births or deaths, and you just fit into a rota, so you're not employed to do a certain number all the time. So you tend to just say what your availability is and work usually at the weekends when there's people not in the office then, so you do them. But occasionally now you get them during the week to do, because a lot of venues, they offer a cheaper rate during the week.
Yes.
So they have to have people who will go and do the ceremonies. And of course, the people in the reg office are doing births and deaths a lot of the time.
Yes.
So they need a bank of people who can just do that. So I just left work because I was going to do an Open University degree, and I was working for a charity. And then I got a bit bored, you know, thinking, what am I going to do now? I'm not at work. And I must have seen an advert somewhere. So I thought, well, I'll actually apply for doing that. Just did a quick interview. And here I am 10 years later and probably nearly 1,000 weddings later, still doing it.
10 years, that's fantastic.
It is amazing, yeah.
Did you have to have any qualifications then?
No, none at all.
Fantastic. No. Just the fact that you can speak clearly, obviously, is a huge advantage.
I suppose, yes, it is. But funnily enough, people think taking the wedding is the most important part. But the most important part really is doing the writing, because that is the legal part. The register goes in the safe forever and ever. There has to be no mistakes in it at all. And if you do make a mistake on the day, you have to cross-reference it and get people to sign it and all sorts of things like that.
Okay, so you have to...
So you have to do that. And then the certificate, which they take away to say that they are married, if you make any mistakes on that, you have to put a line through and start again.
Oh.
So I find the writing quite difficult because I'm quite a nosy person. You might be surprised about that. But, so I quite like to watch what's going on in the wedding, and you really have to concentrate if you're doing the writing, because if you do make that mistake and you have to start again, they could be waiting to take their certificate with them, and you're waiting for you to finish it, and you could be on your sort of sixth copy because you've made all those mistakes.
Oh my goodness, you don't realise how much there is to it, do you?
You don't.
And of course, everybody is there just for the moment.
Yes,
they're thinking about what you're saying.
Yes.
But they're not actually thinking about what you're doing.
No, exactly.
Otherwise, I suppose.
And I think a lot of people who decide they want to do it think, oh, it'd be lovely taking people's weddings. But sometimes it is a bit daunting because you go into a room with, say, 250 people, all guests, and suddenly they see you and they all stop talking and look at you. And that in itself some people find a bit daunting because, you know, you're not used to perhaps talking in front of people or doing things like that. So... You know, it's amazing, really, the experience it does give you.
Do you ever get asked to add extra content? Is that part?
Definitely.
So you do
most
all the
of
time?
It is extra content, in fact, because you can get married in 2 or 3 minutes legally. There are only 3 things that you have to do legally. First of all, the registrar has to tell you that marriage, according to the law of this country, is the union of 2 people voluntarily entered into, to the exclusion of all others. And then the next bit is they have to declare in front of the registrar and their 2 witnesses that they are free and lawfully to marry each other. They have to declare that. Mm-hmm. And then they have to say, you know, I, whatever their name is, take you so-and-so to be my lawful wedded wife and vice versa. And then they're legally married. So in fact, when I've done them at the reg office sometimes, they can come along in their lunch break, just do that and then go back to work.
Oh my goodness.
That's... So weddings are not all that people think they are these days. It's very, very different.
And there are people out there, obviously, that want to keep it really simple for whatever reason
Definitely.
Keep it really simple and quick.
But often these days people are going somewhere else to have a ceremony on the beach or going abroad to have something, but they need to have the legal part done in this country because that's where they're legally getting married. So it's interesting. There's even now there's things that happen which you're surprised about.
Yes.
You know, you think nearly, it must be about 1,000 later that you think, oh, no, another wedding. But there's various things that happen and you think, gosh, I could never imagine that happening in our day or whatever.
We're all so different, aren't we?
We are.
And we all want to put our own stamp on things. I think that's where weddings are hugely... why they're hugely expensive as well is because
Definitely.
We tend to put our own stamp on.
Yes.
I do remember my sister, it was her, she was on a second marriage, and she put raffle tickets under the chairs. And so whoever drew out the winning ticket was a witness.
Oh,
and
that's
I picked that out. And I thought, what a lovely thing to do, because she couldn't choose specifically anyone in the family because they all meant as much to her.
Yes, yes.
And I thought that was a really good idea, actually. Have you had anything like that happen?
I haven't that, but it's very easy, I think, to upset people because you haven't invited them or something, and even people who are your friends.
Yes.
And I've often had requests from people to say, can you ask the guests not to take any pictures and put them on Facebook? Because, you know, if people see it and they think, oh, I didn't know they were getting married, they never invited me. And it can alienate, you know.
And also, actually, the photographs I've noticed in a wedding that I've been to recently, people taking photographs gets in the way of the main photographer.
Yeah, definitely.
And
they
so
do.
I completely, I actually agree with that.
Yes, I do. Yeah,
we want
I do.
To be selfish about our photographs, but I don't think we should.
No. And I mean, the other weeks, and somebody said to me, oh, can you announce I don't want any photographs taken on my way in because I want people to look at me. And of course, people get their mobile phones out now, which they never used
yes,
to.
Yeah.
And so I announced that. And the bride came in, and there were still people got their phones out and did it. So what do you do? You can only ask, but some people think, oh, I still want to take a picture and
yes.
everything.
And it is their day, isn't it?
It is, so yes,
I think,
it is.
So have you had anything really unusual happen that you're allowed to...
Well, I can still sort of tell people things that happened that didn't
yes.
happen in our day. I mean, one the other week... Everybody, all the guests were there. The groom was at the front waiting for his bride to come in and kept looking at the watch and thinking, oh, that's strange. You know, she's a bit late or whatever. And I think people think, oh, I hope she hasn't changed her mind, you know, as you do.
Yes.
So I thought, well, I'll go out and find out what's happened here. And I said to the people who were sort of doing the ushering, is the bride okay? And said, oh, yes, she's just breastfeeding her baby at the moment. And you think, oh, okay, you know, which, you know, it's fine because at least if you had a hungry baby there, it might
yes.
start crying.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just think, oh, right, that's interesting. And then there was another one recently as well. When people often get emotional when they see each other for the first time. You know, when the bride comes up and she's wearing a lovely dress and all this sort of thing.
Lovely
the groom,
moment.
Yeah, and the groom usually sort of says something to her and they get a bit emotional. But she got very emotional when he'd said this to her. Right through the ceremony, and afterwards I said, oh, is the bride okay? He said, well, not really, because he said he didn't like her dress.
Oh, no! Oh, my gosh, you can't say that, can you?
Well, and even if you thought it, you think, oh, gosh, if when I'd married my husband, he'd said that, I think I would have walked out, you know.
Yes.
It's very strange.
Oh, because the dress is, it's very difficult, isn't it? We
yes,
all
it
fall
is.
In love with the dress. Those of us that
yes,
have,
yes, we
you
do.
Know, bought the dress.
Yes, exactly, and you think you,
yes.
you're looking your best and everything.
Yeah.
And you think, even if he'd sort of said that to her later when he'd had a few drinks and joked about it or something.
Yeah.
But to say that, it was
very strange.
Yeah,
we all know what it's like. But my dress actually came from Weybridge.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
And I remember how important it was. So, gosh, that's a funny thing to say, isn't
it? Is.
It?
It's
oh,
a very
dear,
strange.
Poor
and, then,
guy.
And people do all sorts of things now, you know, like... one of the couples said, oh, we like making each other laugh. And I thought, well, that's a good thing. So anyway, the groom was at the front and the bride came round and he turned to face her. And he started going, sort of doing like symbols on his hand. You know, I thought, what's strange here? Then he put his hand up to his mouth as though he was thinking, wow, she looks nice. Took his hand away and he was wearing a fake moustache.
Oh,
and she just creased up laughing, thinking, you know, that's just so funny, you know.
People putting their own stamp on it again.
Yes, totally.
Do you have but music?
Yes, music,
you have music
yes.
as well.
And the nice thing about it is you can choose music that means something to you rather than traditional stuff, you know. It's also and readings as well. You can have,
yeah.
as long as they're not religious, you can have things. We've had things about all different sorts of animals. We've had dogs bringing up the rings. We've had owls flying in with rings on their feet and things.
And amazing.
An Indian chap recently said he was having his main wedding in India, but he wanted to give it a bit of a, well, an Indian theme, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so I said, what did you have in mind? He said, well, he said, I wanted to arrive at the reg office on an elephant, but I couldn't find one. You know, and I thought, okay.
You know, would the floorboard support an elephant?
Yes, I know. So it's lots of different things anyway.
It sounds amazing.
But yes,
I'm sure. Talking about having lots of different things, you know, at the event itself, what do you think about children, young children? Because I always wanted my friends' children there.
Mm.
I know it's a personal thing, but from your point of view?
Well, I think children are welcome as long as they don't spoil the ceremony
yeah.
and make too much noise because I think it can spoil it because you can't hear what's going on. So
yeah.
I think it's fine if your children are behaving, but if one of them starts making a noise, I think somebody should make them go out or take them out, really,
yes, yeah.
because it's not really fair on the rest
yeah.
of the team, really. So that's it,
that.
Really.
So
anyway.
Yeah, so it's gone quick.
Is that
it? Is that the end of our...
Well, I think
we're
getting towards the end of the programme now.
And there's so much more to find out about it.
Yes,
that's really interesting. Thank you, Alison.
That's all right.
As a regular Just Woman presenter, Alison interviewed women from many different walks of life. In the next interview, I was co-presenting with her and we interviewed Nicola Males of Willow Bakery, an award-winning micro-bakery and baking school. Here, Nicola shares with us her passion for real bread and the best, most wholesome ingredients for all her bakes.
And welcome back to the final part of our Just Women programme. Our final guest today is Nicola Mayle. So welcome into the studio, Nicola.
Thank you very much.
We're going to talk about something which we're all very interested in, which is food.
Oh, yes,
definitely.
Definitely,
especially at this time of day. So when did your interest in baking actually start?
Probably a long time ago. When I was a child, I was always really interested in all things cooking and baking. My grandmother was used to be a cook in a house a long, long time ago, in a big house. So I've always shared her passion for all things baking. But most recently, it was about 18 months ago that I started baking bread in real earnest, I have to say, yeah.
So was there something about commercial bread or even home-cooked bread that sometimes you thought, I don't really like that very much, I'm going to try and do something better?
Yeah, so I started baking about 18 months, 2 years ago, just after I lost my mum. My husband said to me, you know, get into some baking, it will really help to distract you. And then I started making my own bread again, because I had been making bread before. And since having my son, I kind of got out into the habit of, you know, baking my own bread. So I kind of got back into that again. And then I started thinking, well, actually, you know, when I look at the ingredients on a loaf of bread or cake or, you know, any baked goods, when you go into a supermarket, you find all these bizarre ingredients that you don't even know how to say the name of them. And I realised that actually, you know, when I was making bread from home, I was literally using flour, yeast, salt and water. And it tasted pretty good. Mm. Then I realised that actually if I was it probably just wasn't me that was, you know, was feeling this way about the food that we're eating, what we're ingesting, what we're putting in our bodies, and actually also how it's affecting our children. So I started to do some more research into it, and I came across the Real Bread campaign, and I joined up, I became a member, and started to find out more about sourdough in particular, which is what I specialise in now, is sourdough bread.
So when you say the Real Bread campaign, who started that and how long has that been going?
I can't remember the guy's name that started it, but it's been going for a few years. It's probably been going for about 5 or 6 years. If you go online and do a search for Real Bread campaign, they've got a website. So it's for people that have a genuine interest in sourdough bread, but it's also for bakers and, you know, commercial bakeries as well as general public and micro bakeries like me. So they are an organisation that promotes people enjoying real bread, as opposed to bread that has poor ingredients, preservatives, additives, all sorts of things added to it.
So they call real bread just things that are natural rather than all these additives.
Yeah, everything that's natural, it's real bread for me, and for part of for the Real Bread campaign, is all about bread that just has natural ingredients in it. That's no flour improvers, which often you find when you buy a loaf of bread, you'll see all sorts of flour improvers added, as well as, you know, preservatives, additives, all sorts of different products to maintain the shelf life of a loaf of bread.
So if you want to make your own, can you get these ingredients in the supermarket, or is it harder to even find them in there? When you say about flour, it's bread flour you buy in the supermarket.
Yes.
With other things in it.
No. So most bread flour you buy in the supermarket, you can buy without flour improvers in. Sometimes if you buy the pre-packed bread flour, so in that all you need to do is put this pre-made flour recipe for a white loaf of bread or a brown loaf of bread, put that into your bread machine or mix it up and put it into a tin. Sometimes they have flour improvers added to them. But if you go to the supermarket to buy flour for bread, you can buy
stone milled or just strong white bread flour that doesn't have anything added to it. So you can quite easily at home make a loaf of bread using flour you've bought from the supermarket. You just need to remember to look at the label on the back to make sure.
But of course you run training courses, don't you, for members of the public to cook their own bread,
exactly.
To bake their own bread rather.
Yeah, and I specialise in teaching people artisan bread methods. So that's all the methods involved in making a really flavourful loaf of bread. And that can be what we call pre-ferments, which is take a little bit of the ingredients the day before and letting it sit on the side and then adding it to the main dough ingredients the next day, so that you get more flavour. The more that a dough has, more time that a dough has to prove, the more flavour you'll get, and the more the enzymes will be broken down, so that when you eat it, you don't get necessarily the bloat, the tummy bloat that you might get if you were to buy a loaf of bread from the supermarket. So I teach all of those types of techniques during my artisan bread course.
And the sourdough, I believe from your website, it said it had to be fermented about 12 hours or something?
Yeah, at least 12 hours, yeah. You have to ferment for at least 12, but you can do anything up to 48 hours. I personally do 24 hours. When I do my weekly bake of sourdough bread for my local community, I do around 24 hours. So it goes into the fridge, it sits there for 24 hours and it comes out, has its final proof and goes into the oven.
And why did you decide to specialise in sourdough? What attracted you to it?
Because it was just so naturally better for you than any other types of bread. Because like I was saying about the enzymes breaking down, the longer that a bread is fermenting or proving, the longer that the natural breakdown of enzymes happens. So the longer that it, you know, over that time, basically all of those enzymes are being broken down. So the method today for a loaf of bread that you might buy in the supermarket is for that to happen really, really fast. Because their production methods and the way they want to be able to ship it out and sell it fast means that that production has to happen quite fast. Whereas for a real bread, we're talking about a long fermentation, that's even better for the body. So that's why I decided to specialise in it, because there's a lot of people suffering stress, IBS, all these kind of issues related with, the stresses in our lives.
Indeed, yes.
And actually, are foregoing bread.
Yes, well, I'm gluten-free, so I can't eat bread. So,
and there's a lot of people that are gluten-free who have gone to sourdough bread and found actually that where they had a gluten intolerance before, sourdough bread doesn't give them that same problem.
Oh, well, I must try that.
Yeah, so
good.
It's a lot healthier, it's a lot better for you, and it literally is natural yeast. So it's what I've created. A starter is what I've created, a sourdough starter that's just flour and water that sits on the side. It takes in all the yeast organisms and it grows into a natural yeast. I don't put any artificial ingredients in it at all.
Right.
So it's literally
flour,
water,
and salt. And how can people buy your bread?
So I do artisan market. I'll do other events throughout the year, which I'll post to the website. Or they can come along to my weekly bake. So if they go to the website, which is willowmicrobakery.co.uk, you can sign up for the newsletter. I send out a weekly bake of the three different sourdoughs that I'm baking that week. And that can be, for instance, this week I'm doing seeded sourdough, toasted oats, and I'm doing something called Willow Wild.
Sounds
which
wonderful.
Is just a classic white sourdough.
Yeah. Yes.
So you order online, you can pay online, or you can come and pay when you pick up. You come on the Friday evening between 5 and 7 and you pick up your bread and you've got your bread for the weekend.
That's wonderful. Sounds great. And then getting back to the courses, I was intrigued to see you do one called Nordic Baking.
Yes.
What is that all about?
It's very popular. So Nordic baking is partly sourdough, but partly some of the sweet stuff. And the sweet stuff's okay, because it's all about moderation, okay? So partly sourdough in, it's all the Danish types of rye that they do, and the Nordic rye, which is all, you know, really healthy, lasts for a long time. A Nordic rye loaf will last for at least a couple of weeks with no additives or preservatives added to it. So it's teaching that, but it's also teaching really delicious cardamom, cinnamon type breads. So the Scandinavian breads usually have quite a lot of cardamom, ground cardamom in them. They're quite spiced.
Yes, it sounds like it. Yeah. Yes,
so it's just teaching some really, you know, lovely, soft and buttery types of bread as well.
Mm. These breads then that you make that are different to the ones you buy in the shops, would you still use them for the same things, you know, like for breakfast, having marmalade on them with soup, yes, and things like that? Or are they better eaten in a different way?
So sourdough bread probably isn't as great for sandwiches, I would say, but for open sandwiches, possibly. They're not as, the crumb isn't quite as soft and crumbly as you might find a loaf of bread from the supermarket would be. So I find them, they're great for toast. Sourdough bread is great for toast, and you can put any number of toppings, you know, like you would anyway. Smashed avocado is just perfect on sourdough.
Oh, sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Yes. But of course all the sweets, you know, lovely jams goes, and all just a lovely butter, you know, a really nice, I particularly like a really nice unsalted butter on a, on a, just cutting open sourdough, slicing it and just having it fresh out of the oven for me is the best. So it's not quite great for sandwiches, I would say, but brilliant for lots of other things. And you can toast it, you could cut it up and use it in salads for croutons or soups, that kind of thing.
So very versatile then.
Yeah, very versatile. And you get a lot more flavour. You get a lot more natural flavour in a sourdough loaf than you would in a traditional loaf of bread.
So can you actually buy sourdough bread in shops, or do they not market it at all now?
So you can buy sourdough even in supermarkets. There is no legislation around the word sourdough. So anybody could call their bread sourdough. And often what they do is big manufacturers, they put in a flavour of sourdough, but you have to make sure you check the ingredients list, because often they will also add commercial baker's yeast, and they'll also add lots of other things. So just because it says sourdough on the packet of your supermarket loaf doesn't mean it's actually a sourdough. Like I said, there's no legislation around the word sourdough. So you, anybody could call their bread sourdough, but what you need to do is, when you're looking at a loaf of bread that says it's sourdough, that you're looking for just flour, water, and natural yeast, and not commercial baker's yeast. So you can get it.
But not the same as making your own.
It's not the same as making your own, or it's not the same as going to an artisan baker. You know, there are artisan bakers around that will be using artisan techniques. All my bread is handmade bread, hand-shaped, and lovingly put in the oven. It's not quite like that when you go to a supermarket.
No, absolutely not. And I gather you're also a bread angel.
I'm a bread angel. I started out as a bread angel. So I was taught, bread angels are a group of individuals across the country, and in fact wider. I think there's one in France and one in Jersey, that we train to be, to teach other people how to make bread and to provide bread for the local community. So I did the course, the Bread Angels course, and now I'm supported by a wonderful group of not just women, I have to say, but men as well, that are all individual bakers like me, micro bakers baking bread for their local, real bread, I should say, for their local community.
So can you give us again the details of where people can find out about your courses? Because I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who'd love to come on them. I would, for one.
Absolutely, me too.
So if you go to the website, www.willowmicrobakery.co.uk, all the information on there is on, for all my courses, all my events that I do, so my markets, and my weekly bake, All that information and the shop that you'll find is all on the website, and I'm on Facebook as well, and I'm Willow Home Bakery on Facebook.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming in today, and I look forward to coming to one of your classes.
And that concludes this special tribute programme to Alison. She was an inspirational woman, and we will miss her greatly. The next edition of Just Women will be next Tuesday at 1 o'clock. We're going to play out the end of the show with Yasmin Giles singing Killing Me Softly. Yasmin was a dear friend of Alison's. So it's goodbye from me, Jackie Mitchell.
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly with his song. Singing my life with
beautiful song. Thank you.